Behind Our Eyes presents the Beau Book Launch for Tuesday, February 27, 2024. Tonight's featured author is Peter Altschul with his first book, Breaking Barriers. Peter will be interviewed by fellow Beau member, journalist Deborah Kendrick. Welcome, everyone. I'm Marlene Massad. Your co-host is fellow author Deanna Quietwater Noriega. There will be time for questions following the interview. Over to you, Deborah.
All right. So, yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I was delighted Peter wanted me to do this again. We have great fun doing these kinds of things together. When I first read this particular book of Peter's, his first book about a dozen years ago, which again is titled Breaking Barriers, Working and Loving While Blind, it was because Peter reached out to me and asked me to read a draft copy to get my opinion. And my opinion then, as now, is that it's quite a lovely book. But it was interesting to me when I revisited it to be ready for this evening, how much I'd forgotten. I remembered it as a romance. And while that's a part of the story, I remembered it as a memoir, of course, which it is. But the romance is a smaller part than all of the discussion of five guide dogs. And we'll talk about both parts as we go on. But I just want to say, as a fellow guide dog handler and fellow author, that in particular, Peter's handling of the bonding and the training and the interaction between dog and human and the magic of using a guide dog as a blind person is just beautiful. It's really quite excellent and gives the message, I think, that we all want to have delivered. So, but before I jump into any questions, I want to ask kind of a humorous one that I suspect everybody here wondered about. And that is, some people, I've heard from some authors about struggling to get their books recorded on BARD, even though NLS makes a concerted effort to produce books that have anything to do with disability or written by authors with disabilities, but it doesn't always pan out that way for people. Sometimes things just get stuck. And how, Mr. Peter Altschul, did you score two copies on BARD, read by two of the most renowned narrators? There's one version read by Jack Fox and another read by David Hartley Margolin. How'd you do that?
First of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. So it's a really bizarre story. So when I book became published, I reached out to the Missouri Library, Wilfrid Library for the Blind, and said, would you consider reading this book? And the person there said, send us a copy of the book. And I did. And they said, great, we're happy to read it. And so they were reading the book and I read the prologue. And as this was going on, I got an email from a friend of mine saying, congratulations, your book is out on BARD. Well, I didn't know that because it was still being recorded. So somebody, and I still don't know who, sent the book to another library. And that's the book that came out first. And to this day, I still don't know how it happened. I'm grateful for whoever did it and how it happened.
Oh, my gosh. So which one? Now, the earlier number is Jack Fox.
That's right. Jack Fox is the earlier one. And truth, I didn't know there was another version that came out. So I'm assuming that's the one that came out through Missouri. But I don't even know that as a fact.
Well, the David Hartley Margolin has a 109 DB number, which means it was done much later than the Jack Fox.
Then the answer is I have no clue. The whole thing is a mystery. People often ask me how I did it, and I tell them what I know. The other two books were straightforward. I reached out to the Wolfner Library. They said, we're happy to record it. And they both were recorded. But the first one is one of those mysteries that I'll never know the answer to. I mean, who was the one who made the first intro? Because it certainly wasn't me.
And before we go forward, I want to ask you another question. And that is, I think many of us here read in dual modalities, Braille and audio, or print and audio, whatever. When I first read your book, I read it in Braille because I read the copy that you sent me. It was probably a DLCX file or a DLC file or a BRF file. I don't remember, but I read the copy that you sent me. And this time I listened. I listened to a little bit of Jack Fox, and then I listened to the whole thing of David Hartley Marglin, who I think has a better voice for your kind of book. But I'm wondering, is the fact that it struck me so differently just my brain hearing differently than it reads? Or were there actually a fair number of changes after you sent out draft copies?
There were no draft changes that I'm aware of.
Really?
So I wasn't even aware the book was re-recorded. So I'm like totally behind the curve when it comes to this particular book. And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
What I will say, though, was when I, of course, wrote it on a Braille display, a Braille note taker, but I listened to the book as I was reading it on my Braille display. Using this voice, and I really do take, as a musician, sort of the way the book flows, and trying to vary the length of the sentences and all that stuff to make it interesting to the ear, and I'm sort of intrigued that you listened to it and heard it a different way.
Yeah, well, let's I'm going to jump around for a minute since you brought up the method of writing, because I always want to know that, how other people, what tools you use to write and what tools you use to proofread. So do you always write in Braille, or is that just what you did 12 years ago?
No, I always write in Braille. I think in Braille better than I do writing on a QWERTY keyboard. I can write on a QWERTY keyboard. I'm pretty good at it, but I think better in Braille. In literary Braille, not UEB Braille, by the way. I'm not against UEB Braille, but I don't write in UEB Braille.
It's our age. None of us do.
That's right.
I agree with you about the listening. I write everything. I write on a computer, but with Braille, and I read it back in Braille, and my listening, where the listening comes in for me, is that I read everything out loud myself. I can't tolerate hearing the speech synthesizer read it, but I read it to myself, and I hear in my own voice where it's bumpy and fix it. So so you have, as I mentioned earlier, such a great command of language for describing this whole dog-human relationship that we all cherish so much. And throughout the book, not just the dog parts, but the entire book, they're all dated entries. And I wondered, were you keeping journals throughout all of these years, and you were dipping back into journal entries? How did you do that with the dates? I mean, certainly you don't have an eidetic memory, right?
No. So what happened was, the first two parts of the book, where I write about going to Guiding Eyes and getting Jules, which was the dog at the time, and then the home training part, I did keep a journal. And the reason I kept a journal was because when I went to Guiding Eyes, I had many people who knew I was getting a new dog and wanted to know what was going on. And this was before blogging was such a big deal. And so every day while I was waiting for my journeys, the guide dog journeys, I'd go up to the Guiding Eyes computer or my home computer and just write sort of a general sense of what went on that day. And And then I would send it out as a chain email to everybody. You know, there were like probably 30 or 40 people I'd send this out to. And that really was the genesis of the book, those emails. And as I write in the book, you know, I got home and, you know, I call to sort of reconnect and start up my business ventures again. And, you know, I'd call and say, okay, what's going on? What do I need to do next? And say, forget that. We want to meet your dog. And, right. and several folks said, you should write a book based on this. And I thought they were nuts, but I ended up doing just that.
So the idea or the germ of the idea of turning this into a book was actually much earlier than your meeting Lisa. It was there when you were in training with Jules.
Well, it really didn't start until I met Lisa, because Lisa sort of challenged me to take a nonfiction writing course, a PhD level writing course. And I said to her, I've never taken a writing course, creative writing course. She said, well, you know, sign up for the course and send a note to the professor. If she takes you in, fine. I thought she'd never take me in. So I sent her an email with some of my reports that I'd written, and she accepted me. To my great shock, I thought, okay, well, if she accepted me to a PhD level course with no experience in writing at all, except, you know, bureaucratic writing, I better take this more seriously. And I did. And that really is when the book started to take shape.
I especially appreciated how you continue to weave the experiences of a pedestrian or a professional or any other role as a blind person into the narrative in a really natural way. I think for some of us that's difficult to do. We don't want to talk about the things we have to do that are a little bit different or a little bit extra, but you just drop things in, like, you know, I turned my head in the direction of the person speaking to me, or I felt with my feet for a particular crack in the sidewalk, or I folded the $20 bill into thirds so I could identify it later. Was that a conscious decision on your part to be sure that you wove the techniques of blindness into the narrative, or is it something that you just do so naturally that you weren't aware of it?
Well, my first goal was to write a good story. I wasn't especially interested in writing to educate sighted people about blind people. That was not my goal. So I wanted to write a good story. And what I really wanted to do, my first goal of the book, you know how sports coaches write about what they learned as a football coach or a basketball coach and what business people can learn. My first idea of the book was to take my experiences at guide dog school and use my background as an organizational psychologist to sort of say, what can business people learn from the sort of unique experience that that I got at Guiding Eyes? And so there's a lot of that sort of spread out through the first three parts of the book anyway. And then, you know, I didn't want to sort of ignore the blind part. And so as I sort of, but I wanted to subsume it to the story. And so, you know, I sort of mentioned things as sort of color, you know, as you mentioned, the folding of the $20 bill, or, you know, mentioning that the dog commands, and, you know, feeling, as you said, there's sort of lots of sort of subtle things that are sort of there. But, you know, my goal was not so much to educate, but to tell a good story. And if, you know, putting those things in helps educate, that's great. But that wasn't my primary mission.
Were there moments when you were writing a section that you would think, well, wait a minute, now how exactly did I do that? How did I know that person was doing that, or that building was there, or that doorway was there? I need to insert that language to make it clear to the reader. Or did it just flow so smoothly to you because you're sort of blind centric?
Well, excuse me, recovering from a virus. What often happened, as I remember it, is I would leave some of those details out, and then when I finished book and I started sending it around for feedback and working with the iUniverse editor, there were times when they'd say, how did you do that? You know, how did you, you know, that would be really interesting for people to know. And so some of it was inserted as I was writing it, but a good deal of it was inserted as I was editing. because, as again, my primary goal was to tell a story, and
right. Okay.
But I got a lot of really good feedback about how did you do that? You know, that would be an interesting part of the color of the story. And I thought, okay, I can do that. That makes sense to me. So,
yeah.
So a lot was done post writing and in the editing part.
Good editor.
Very good editor. I was very, very fortunate.
Let's talk about that for a minute. And I remember you telling me at the time, but hey, it was a long time ago, that you went with iUniverse because you had a friend who was part of that company or something. But many of the people here have gone another route in publishing books. Can you talk about how iUniverse?
The only reason I used iUniverse is because my friend happened to be the president of the organization, and they gave me like a 60% discount.
Okay.
And that made it affordable for me. I would never recommend anybody use that organization because they charge too much.
I was
really fortunate. I got a really good deal, and I got a publicity package. I got a really good editor, you know, which taught me so much about how to think about editing.
But you wouldn't recommend them to others.
I if you guys have lots of money, then go for it. But unfortunately, especially now, that book came out in 2012.
Right.
Especially now, where the there's so much options to self-publish your own stuff. I would absolutely not recommend iUniverse to anybody. I'm grateful for what they did for me, but unless you can get that 60% discount as I got, it's too much money. So
now I'm going to ask you about and sort of play it intended on a title of one of your other books, but to aim right directly for that elephant in the room, a typical concern of most writers writing memoir is how the work will affect others who are named in the book. I know I haven't written a memoir, actually, but I used to say when I was a lot younger and people would encourage me, I'd say, I'm not writing a memoir till all the main players are dead. Because I think it's something that a lot of us worry about. So you named a lot of people by name in this book. And actually, there were only one or two where you glaringly, specifically seem to avoid naming the names. So I have a couple of questions connected to this. How did you make those decisions? Did you consult with people who were alive regarding their inclusion by name in the book? And maybe the most glaring elephant in the room, how do you handle the fact that relationships have shifted and you're no longer married to the person who has a star role in a really good story?
And,
summing all that up, do you have... From your experience, once you explain all those things to us, does it lead you to any wisdom that you could use to guide other writers in going forward writing memoir?
Yeah, those are all complicated and good questions. So let's start with naming people. Generally, I only name those people who had a positive influence on my life. Those who I write about with a negative thing, I don't name. I think that's the general rule I used. When I did talk to some of these folk to get their remembrances of, I asked a couple of Guiding Eyes trainers to send me some emails, and so I could get their words exactly rather than what I remember them saying, which I'm grateful I did, because sometimes it's not what I remember them saying, or it's not what they wanted to say, or however you want to frame that.
Right, smart.
Yeah. So I did that, and that worked really well for me. I think I changed a couple of names because there are two people with the same name, for example, and it was easier just to change a name and mention that in the book somewhere. I can't remember exactly how that worked. And getting back to Lisa, of course, was the person I married at the end of the book. The book ends with the wedding.
Right.
And then there's an epilogue, but the book essentially ends with the wedding, which was a It was a very joyous and traumatic day for lots of reasons, which you can read about in the book. And when I wrote the book, the marriage was going very well, and I never had any indication of what was going to happen 2 or 3 years at, well, 4 or 5 years after the book was published. And that is that Lisa and I ended up divorcing. And it was a very sort of sad and sort of difficult time for everybody involved. And I probably should also say that about a month ago, Lisa died suddenly. And which has been really sort of difficult for me and her kids, my stepkids. And we're also trying to sort of work through that as best we can. But it's been from the past, I don't know, 5 years has been a very sort of difficult part of my life. And maybe I'll write about that some other time. But, you know, when that book came out, everything was great. You know, the book ends on a very positive note. Unfortunately, life doesn't always stay that way. And it didn't in Lisa's and my case. I'm not quite sure what to say more than that, but that's the way life works sometimes.
When I, as just an aside, when I read the photo captions in the audiobook narrated version, I was surprised that there were no photos from the wedding. Was that an accident? There were no photos. And because your description of the wedding is so visual, you read it and you can see that backyard, you can smell the flowers and hear the music. And if you've ever heard Gordon perform, you can hear him making the announcements about the cutting of the cake. It's a very sensual, beautiful description, and yet you didn't include any photos. Was that an accident?
No, that's because there weren't any photos, and it's a really weird story. So we had a photographer, and the wedding was so delayed because of the chaos that happened beforehand, which I write about in the book, that we never took any group pictures because we were, you know, the wedding was delayed 45 minutes because of what happened, and so the photographer took sort of random pictures about what happened. But as I remember, none of them were good enough to include in the book. That was sort of the verdict of the folks who we, talked about this. And, of course, I can't see the pictures. But, you know, we sort of ran some of them by folks who had a better visual eye than either Lisa or I did. And the basic sense was these aren't very good. So that's why. It was just a weird, as I said, traumatic day in many ways. And one of the things that got lost was there weren't any pictures.
Wow. Yeah, because you mentioned a photographer in the writing. You mentioned.
Yeah.
So I thought, there was a photographer there.
There was a photographer there, but there weren't any group pictures. It was just really, really confusing. So he sort of took pictures at random. And as best as I remember, none of them were good enough to make the book.
Are you doing any kind of, are you doing any writing right now? And are you thinking about any kind of follow-up to this book?
Excuse me.
Sequel, if you will.
Yeah, so the answer to your question is no, I'm not doing any writing now. I'm one of these people, there are many folks in Behind Our Eyes who thrive on writing. And I admire those people. They have a muse for writing. I do not. I never have. And, you know, I sort of did these three books against my better judgment. And I know I'm a good writer, but it's not how I gain my energy. It's, you know, I don't, that's just not the way I am. I gain energy by playing music and writing music. I gain energy by making presentations about things that interest me. And in fact, the only reason I wrote these three books is I wasn't making presentations. I think that sort of was the substitute. Mm-hmm. And so the answer to your second question, I don't rule out the possibility of me writing another memoir or writing an edition or something. But I don't think the time is quite right yet. For those who don't know, I moved out here to Coos Bay, Oregon last September and married a wonderful woman who lives here, Carrie Muth. So we've been happily married since December. So the time isn't right yet. And there may come a time when I decide that it's time to write something, or there may not. I, you know, as I said, I'm not driven to write, which is sort of a weird thing, but it's, you know, that's who I am.
I want to touch briefly again on this business of naming names. You said that you asked people for emails, and I think that's brilliant. That's a really good idea. But I wonder, was there any fallout in any direction? Did you hear from people who commented one way or another about how they were mentioned or how someone they cared about was mentioned in the book?
No. And again, I was really, really careful as you know, for those, and I write about some sort of negative experiences I had with certain people in the book, mostly bosses, but I never named them. So, you know, those folks who I generally write about had very positive parts, and a lot of them sent me messages saying that this was awesome. Thank you so much for especially the Guiding Eyes trainers were very appreciative. And my mom, of course, were very appreciative of how they were talked about in the book. So, you know, so the fact that I didn't mention those people who were destructive influences, I think made a difference.
Do you have a dog now? I mean, time's gone by. If you do, you'd be on sixth or seventh, right?
My seventh dog. I got him in 2022, December. So I've had him for, or maybe it's 2021. Yeah. No. I'm thinking about this. When did I get him? It must have been 2022. So I've had him for, you know, over a year. He is an 85-pound black lab male named Fredo, who is a huge hit around here, especially among Carrie's grandkids. He is great. He's a great worker. He's a goofball. You know, it's one thing to have a goofball who's 70 pounds or 60 pounds. He's an 85-pound goofball. So he can he creates more space and noise when he's a goofball, but he's great. He's a wonderful dog, and he gets along well with everybody. And he's a pest, but all my dogs are pests, so that's nothing new. Yeah, you start with the Weimaraner as I did, and I write about that in the book. You know, every other dog is easy.
Yeah, well, it was kind of amusing that you could not name that dog without saying the Weimaraner every time you met. The other dogs only got names, but she always got an attribute.
Well, yeah, it is funny, and but she was a really unusual, well, that unusual breed for a guide dog, and a really just a really unusual dog.
One tiny little thing, I just want to get your take on this, and then we'll open it up because I'm sure other people have questions as well. One thing that I noticed, and again, it was one of those things that I thought to myself, I didn't even notice that when I read this book the first time. But every time you talk about a new job or a new situation, a phrase you use repeatedly in the book is, I was the first blind person. And I don't know, what's your take on that? Why do you think that's important to you?
Because I was raised to pioneer. I mean, mom sort of said, you're probably going to be the first blind person to do the kinds of things that you might end up doing. You know, I was mainstreamed in a time when most blind kids went to a school for the blind. I was the only one of two blind people who went to, in my college group, and I never really connected with that other blind guy. And the first time I really met a group of blind people was getting my first dog at Guiding Eyes. That was really the first time I'd been around blind people, with the exception of the summer of my freshman year in high school, where I went to a school for the blind, a sort of summer school for the blind, which was an utter waste of time for me. But anyway, I digress. And so most of the jobs I got once I left the IRS and the Bank of New York were jobs where I was the only blind person there. And I was used to being the only blind person everywhere I went. And while it was a challenge sometimes and lonely and frustrating and all those fill in the blanks, it was built in my DNA. And so I looked for jobs that I thought I was really good at, but I also essentially stayed clear of like voc rehab, in part because I had such lousy experiences with voc rehab. You know, I found most of the counselors I worked with, they're incredibly stupid. Right. I hate to be sort of blunt, but that was sort of the way I didn't want to work for an organization like that. And so I was fortunate and also pretty good at what I do to get these really unique opportunities and take advantage of them.
I don't know. I think maybe that a book project down the road for a multitude of Behind Our Eyes authors, whether or not, because I think I asked you that question selfishly in part, because what you say resonates very much with me. I was always the only one too. But when I was finished with school and started meeting other blind people, I was jealous of people who had always had blind friends, because I thought it was really cool to start having blind friends. And so I just think it would be interesting to hear, to collect people's stories about what does that do, being the only one in the room? Does that make you, you know, weaker or stronger or braver or more afraid? Or, you know, I think
there's... And the answer is all the above. And then there you have the whole issue of imposter.
Exactly.
which you have to sort of work through. And I didn't really start, I went to my first ACB convention in 1987 and gradually have sort of filtered into the blindness community since then. And, you know, I'm now very fortunate to have blind friends, but I'm very much have one foot in both camps. I'm very well aware of that. And I like it the way that is. You know, I can function fairly well in both worlds.
Yeah. Mine was 85. So again, right on par. Well, for those who have not read the book, I encourage you to do so. I enjoyed reading it a second time. It's a lovely book. And I hope we didn't do too many spoilers here, that there will be some surprises. My favorite chapter is the one with the wedding, because of all the music, and it's really good. But so at this point, before we open it to questions, Peter, is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted very much to talk about that you'd like to add before we open it? Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. Were you asking me something, Deb?
I was.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got distracted. Please repeat the question.
Okay. I said, before we open it to questions, is there anything that you particularly wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you that you want to add before we
open it? The one thing I would say and is, for those of you who have an interest in sort of how businesses work and so the dynamics go in the workplace and how to improve things a little bit, there's a lot of that sprinkled throughout the first three parts of the book. And, you know, so if you have a heart for, you know, sort of human relations and the workplace and how to deal with conflict in the workplace and things like that, there's a large component, because I sort of connect what goes on at Guide Dog School to the workplace and make comparisons and make observations. And to me, that's a really important part of the book, for what it's worth.
Great. Okay. So, Deanna, take it away. Do we have some hands?
Uh-oh. Alice's hand is up.
Oops, sorry. Takes a minute for people to unmute.
Hello. I certainly enjoyed reading this book a second time, Peter, and I listened to the David Hartley Margolin version, and I thought he did a very good job narrating your book. And I thank you very much for those chapters about your experiences with your guide dogs, because in 1989 and 90, when I was filling out my application and waiting for my first guide dog in 1990, there were really only two books that I could find at the time. And none of them really showed the realism of working with a guide dog the way your chapters do. And I think that's very important to add to the literature. And I, you know, that you did that in 2012. I think it's a wonderful accomplishment. And so I have a couple of quick questions for you, but I know you don't like writing, which always amazes me when I hear that. But when you finished the book, and these number of years later, are you pleased and proud that you did write this book and give it to others to learn from and enjoy and be entertained by and so forth? And then
go ahead.
I don't know. My other question is that after you spoke about meeting with Vice President Walter Mondale, you made reference to that the Princeton Chapel Choir, you had found out, was going to perform the mass that you had composed when you were a senior at Princeton. And I wonder, is there a recording of that somewhere?
So the answer to the second question is no, there was not, unfortunately. It was recorded, and it was recorded on reel-to-reel tape. Remember back then in the 1970s and early 80s? And it was recorded on that, and I tried to get a good recording on to cassette because those reel-to-reel things degrade over time. I never could get a good recording. So that, unfortunately, does not exist, which I'm sort of sorry about. And one of the projects I have in the back of my mind, if I ever can figure out how to do it, is to sort of re-up the score and modernize it and make some changes to make it easier to sing and try to get it re-performed, because it was a great honor to have the piece performed by that choir. Yeah. And maybe at some point I'll be able to do that. Now that there's technology out there, I can make that happen. To answer your first question, I am really proud. I'm proud of the books. I'm proud of what I've written. And at the same time, if I was sort of skimming the book this weekend to prepare this as well, I'm not sure I'd write the book exactly the same way. I'm not sure I'd have a prologue, for example. Mm-hmm. I think I might, start with chapter one and try to weave the prologue in throughout the book. Again, this is just, me and sort of change some of the, make some subtle changes here and there. But I am really proud of the book. And one of the things I aim to do, Alice and other people, when I wrote the book, I try to make it as realistic as possible, because none of the books I've read, including that book by that guy who I can't remember the name of, who walked down the World Trade Center with his guide dog and sort of helped people get out, whatever the guy's name was.
Michael Hinkson.
Thank you, Hinkson. I found that book absolutely uncomfortable, and I thought the book was awful. And one of the reasons I found it awful is he made the dogs be sort of superhuman. And these dogs are wonderful, but they're great, and they're problems, and they're funny, and they misbehave, and they do great things. And I wanted to write about all of that in the book, because that's the way dogs are. I'm glad you think I did a good job with that, because that was something I really aimed to do. I was sort of tired of reading these superhuman guide dog books that I just found really annoying.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Alice.
Well, I don't see any hands, so maybe it's time for me to think of a question for you, Peter. We've known each other since we both ended up moving to Columbia about the same time, or to the area. I actually was living in Fulton at first, and only moved to Columbia in 2006. But so we've served on boards, we've done a lot of things, and one of the things that you've done in your book is to apologize for some of your arrogance when you were young, and you gained respect for other people as you matured. And I thought that was an interesting thing, that you were not afraid to admit that there was room for some growth there.
Oh, lots of it.
Yeah.
Lots of it.
That was lovely.
Go ahead.
Oh, we do have a hand up now. I was sort of wasting time waiting for somebody's little hand to go up. Abby wants to ask a question.
Well, Peter, it seems to me like I read your book when it first came out, but boy, I tell you, the stuff that you talk about does not seem at all familiar to me. So either I've forgotten it, or maybe I haven't read your book. So I'm definitely looking forward to reading it or rereading it, as the case may be. But I was just wondering, having written a memoir myself, did it ever occur to you to change the names of people that may have been perceived as doing something they shouldn't have been, or maybe, you know, had the best of intentions but didn't do something they should, or anything like that? Did that ever occur to you to change the names instead of, you know, having all the correct names in there for people?
It occurred to me to try to change names, what I tried to do instead was those people who had negative influences on my life, especially bosses, I just didn't name at all.
Right.
To me, that was the solution. You know, so often I'd say my boss, you know, job, or, you know, this boss or that boss. And usually when I wrote about that, it was a negative experience of some kind or other. But those bosses who sort of nurtured me and helped me get better, I did try to name, because they played important positive parts of my life.
Sure.
And so that's sort of the way I thought about that. I want to go back to Deanna, your comment. Abby, are you finished? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that was all I had. So yeah, that's fine. Thank you so
Deanna,
much.
Deanna, I want to go back to your arrogance comment, because I find it sort of an interesting sort of dilemma, because I was really arrogant and growing up, and on one level it served me really poorly, you know, because you know, I thought I was better than people, than, you know, better than I was at lots of things, and, you know, that people deserve to be treated with respect, you know, regardless of who they are and all of that. On the other hand, I was thinking about this when I read a review of a book by a blind guy who got his degree at Harvard Business Review and is now in corporate America. I think if you're going to be a pioneer, you have to have a certain degree of arrogance, or at least a large degree of self-confidence, which can translate into arrogance. And I think it's a puzzle to how to sort of navigate that tension, because I don't think you can do the kind of work that I did and be humble. I know that sounds kind of strange, but I think you really have to be able to sell yourself when you're dealing with, you know, the places I was in.
Well, we're in about the same place right now, in that mm-hmm. I have raised children and you helped raise children, and now you're raising grandchildren and I raised grandchildren, and I'm now working on the greats. But the interesting thing I thought about all of that was that a strong-willed child is a survivor.
Yeah.
The timid child is the one I worry about, because life will not be kind to them, and they have to be strong enough to face it. And I think the children of today are going to face some pretty tough things in their lives, because they were born in a time of plenty and big scientific advances and wonderful toys to play with, you know, getting an iPhone in seventh grade or whatever. And life is not going to be kind to them. And I hope they have the strength and the courage to face it. And that's one of the things I'm grateful for my blindness, because I was basically a shy child, but it made me stand up to life mm-hmm. and find ways to get by, even though it's not my nature to push. And we've got another hand up, Mary.
Let's do it.
You may unmute.
Hello, Peter and Deborah. That's Mary Hyland from Mary. Columbus, Ohio. Hello. And Peter, I have not had the pleasure of reading your book, or your books, I should say, but I am intrigued. And I wonder if you have a DB number.
I unfortunately do not in front of me. But
I do.
Oh, thank you, Deb.
It's 109173.
109173?
Yeah, I'm telling you the David Hartley Marglin one because I think he does a better job of reading Peter's voice.
Yeah.
I mean, his voice physically is not like Peter's voice, but I mean, he narrates the written voice more like.
And then I should also say, Mary, that if you want to read about my other books, which are a series of short essays about a number of different things, they're also on Bard. And if you just type in my name, Peter Altschul, Altschul, you will see the other books. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there are two other books that if you want to read them, I'd be delighted.
Oh, yes, I will. This has been really good. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
And of course, Peter, you may not be aware that Mary has written a book.
I know, Mary, actually do know that, vaguely.
She's written two books.
I've heard about her books.
She has. Yeah. Yes.
She's written two books, but only one of them is on Bard. And I was thinking of Mary when I made the comment initially about some people sort of running into interference getting their books on Bard. I don't it's weird. And yet you're, so I think a lot of it, obviously, from what Peter said is
connections.
I don't think it's connections. Mary has connections, mm-hmm. but it's just, you know, the right person at NLS pushing the right button to make it happen.
I mean, the first book, you know, I still, it's a mystery as to how this all happened. I'm totally mystery. But, you know, once I got that first book on Bard, it was a whole lot easier. Yeah.
What generally happens is someone requests it from a regional library. And I believe Jack Fox operates out of Louisville.
Louisville, right.
APH. And David, I'm not sure.
I think he's out of the studio, the collection of narrators that used to be with AFB in New York.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I was trying to think, you know, which group he's from. But
I have a theory as to who recommended the book to somebody in Louisville, but she's always denied it, so I don't know what to think.
She says, not my fault.
If it wasn't me, because if had I been the person, I'd be boasting about it. But I want to, on a serious note, I want to go back to this business of arrogance, because I had it on my list of topics to ask you about in the interview. And I decided I wasn't sure I wanted to go there. But since it's been brought up by others.
Peter and I are friends, and he knows I didn't mean it in a mean way. I think, curious that he recognized it and he included it in his book, because he wasn't trying to make himself off as Mr. Superblink. He just wanted to tell his story as honestly as he could.
Yeah, I think because that too, the comments about it resonated somewhat with me about my younger self. And I think some of it maybe stems from, if you're the only one, you don't know any other blind people, and you know you're given the message, in my case by a teacher, in your case, Peter, by your mother, that if you're going to succeed, you're going to have to be twice as good as everybody else.
Right.
And I think to find that confidence, you know, about myself, I always say I'm an introvert who learned years ago how to pretend to be an extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I think
that's the same route I went.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to pretend a certain level of arrogance to push out the self-confidence. But then at the same time, when that starts rubbing people the wrong way, which you give examples in the book, then you got to figure out how to temper it and how to pull it back. And I mean, that could be a book, or at least a nice long essay in itself, is that how to find that balance, because without self-confidence, the world is so ready to tell us that we know nothing because we can't see. So without a certain level of confidence, none of us are ever going to succeed at anything. But if you've got too much of it, then you lose ground.
Well, this ties into the sort of the no-win double bind that you read about in sort of diversity literature that whatever you do, you lose kind of thing. So if you're too confident, sometimes that get that knocks down a door for you. But if you continue to use that confidence, it makes you less effective. But if you're not confident enough, you don't break down those doors. But people like you more. And it's a bunch of trade-offs that we all have to live with and try to navigate through.
But I think we could learn, you know, by studying people. I don't know, Ronnie Millsap just jumped into my head. He's blind, extraordinarily successful, and he's the sweetest, most humble person, you know. And I don't even know if he's still alive or how he's doing these days. But if you've ever seen him perform or read his book, there doesn't seem to be an ounce of arrogance in his system. So.
But I'd be curious to know how he broke into the business. You know, did he have to sort of? And the other issue is he's a musician. Musicians and blind people are a little bit different, because we're all supposed to be
musicians.
So that may be part of it. I'm just speculating. I have absolutely no idea, because I've heard Ronnie interviewed, and he seems like a really nice, smart, you know, humble guy. I agree with you. I just wonder how he broke into the business.
Excuse me, this is Marlene. I think we should hear from Brad now, our vice president for Behind Our Eyes.
Oh, hey there, everybody. This is Brad Carello, and I've been asked to stand in for our president, Marilyn Smith, and just talk a little bit about organization Behind Our Eyes. I want to say first that to Deborah and Peter, you guys did a great job. And that whole discussion about the arrogance thing and tempering it was absolutely fascinating. And I mean, there's a whole discussion in that. I mean, there's a couple of hour discussion on that one. In any case, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. So Behind Our Eyes is a 501(c)(3) not-for-profit international agency whose mission is to develop, advance, and promote the writing of people with disabilities, all types of disabilities. And since I've been in the organization for 10 years, and the amount of growth is phenomenal, and it does so many things that I'm definitely going to forget some. As obviously one of the things is book launches. So it creates a platform for disabled writers who have written books to, present the story of their book, of how it was written, and to get it out there to people's awareness and so on and so forth. We also have a twice yearly literary magazine called Magnets and Ladders. And every time I get my copy, I'm absolutely blown away by how much talent there is in that book. Some of the contributors are not actually BOW members, but a lot of them are long-term contributors. And there's just it's just amazing. It's an amazing magazine, in my opinion. We've done three anthologies that contain examples of the writing of our members. we have a couple of three critique groups, small critique groups that meet once a month and enable writers to develop their skills and to get feedback and to learn how to give feedback. We have a thing called the Writer's Workshop, which helps people learn to read and present their work in a professional manner. We've got something called the Writer's Exchange, which is a fairly new operation of ours that allows individuals that we have who have expertise in specific areas to teach free classes that are open to our members. And finally, we have our list, our email list, which It's just, it really is a very cool list. You know, people post their poems and, you know, people comment on them, and it's a great way to learn, but it's also a great way to make connections. I've connected with some of the best people that I've ever had the opportunity to meet through the list. So it's really a great forum. So that's pretty much all I have to say. I think this went really well tonight. I think it was fascinating. And so I'll just say good night to everyone out there, and live long and prosper.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. Thank you, Peter and Deborah, as always, for a very interesting interview. And Brad, for your wonderful comments about our amazing organization. Good night, everyone.